Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show.
Today's guest is Raj Samani, a fellow and chief data scientist at McAfee. We'll get into things. There's obviously a lot that I think I want to try and cover with you. I know we've only got around 30 minutes, so I'll do my best to try and cover as much as we can. I know that you've been really active in a lot of different communities, you know, around technology. What is it, I suppose, that is always compelling for you to get involved in so much kind of, if you want to call it, extracurricular stuff around the kind of tech community?
I mean, it's funny, you know, you say extracurricular, but I don't think any of it extracurricular in any way, shape or form, because, you know, for example, I've been involved with the CSA, the Cloud Security Alliance. I mean, I co-authored one of the books, but, you know, being involved with that group, you're actually involved with shaping the cloud industry, you know, certainly in terms of developing standards and guidance and guidelines. And that has a huge positive impact, not only into my day job, but also kind of broader than that as well. You know, part of the reason I've been involved with campaigns to help young children, not only around online safety, but actually get a career in this industry it's kind of the right thing to do, I feel. And, you know, the good thing is that I've actually got, you know, actually my boss and, you know, our CEO actually encourages us to be more engaged and be more involved. So for me, I've always been, you know, where I remember starting off with the ISSA in the UK and actually, you know, you get to know people, you get to build a network up, but also you get to be involved with initiatives that are going to shape not only our industry, but I think broader than that, because, you know, our dependency on technology is ubiquitous. I mean, you know, what was it just this week? We were reading about pacemakers with vulnerabilities being recalled and, you know, cars being hacked into and claims that planes were being, you know, compromised. And so, it's what we do. I mean, it's more than just a job.
Yeah. Well, I think that goes without saying, that's the way that, you know, you feel about things. I'm obviously kind of an advocate of extracurricular stuff as well. I'll call it that just for the time being. I obviously know that that's not the case, but, I think it is important to get involved, especially if you are kind of passionate about things. And, you know, I think that you can't always impact change internally. And I think that that's what a lot of people get things confused with. I think there's this sense that people engage in communities and, you know, other activities outside of their kind of day job for, you know, personal gain. But I think that in a lot of instances, it's not necessarily that. It's about impacting the industry that you occupy, and surely the industry that you occupy, you should feel passionately enough to ensure that things are working in the way that you would like to see them work. And it's no different than, I suppose, you know, local council in politics or anything like that. It's all about kind of making things as ubiquitous as possible. And it's great to see someone like yourself, you know, getting so involved and impacting change, in a positive way. And I also really like that, you know, the organization that you're working for is a big advocate of getting people involved. I think that there's not enough of that encouragement from organisations, in my opinion.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of these things that we have to ask ourselves, because what is it, by 2020, BMW are going to have, or they claim to have, self-driving cars on the market. And, you know, you want to ask yourself a question. Do you want to live in a world in which, you know, the world around us, I mean, like, everything's going to be digital, everything's going to be enabled, everything's going to be automated in some way, shape, or form. Well, do you want to live in a world in which the cars that we drive, or, you know, the medical equipment we rely upon, are going to be held hostage by ransomware operators? Because the reality is that we've seen ransomware, actually, less become ransomware and become more of a kind of destructive campaign. And we've seen the kind of migration from, you know, what were traditional kind of, you know, desktop and laptop computers to more mobile devices. And, you know, it's not a big stretch to suggest that, you know, we did research last year where we showed ransomware can be installed onto IVI, the in-vehicle infotainment systems. And so if you're comfortable with a world in which the devices we rely upon are going to be held to ransom, then don't do anything. But if you want to do something, if you don't want your children to grow up in that world, then look, just stop complaining. Get involved, get engaged. I mean, you know, one of the initiatives that we co-founded was No More Ransom. And we just did that, right? We're not charging anybody for it. You don't have to be a McAfee customer. And since launch in the year, there's been, the official figure is about £8.5 million pounds that haven't gone into the hands of criminals because of the fact that we've created free decryption tools. And so that's £8 million pounds less that criminals have to reinvest. That's £8 million pounds less, or, you know, 29,000 computers that have their data back, that can continue working. And so, yeah, you know, ask yourself a question. If you're not happy with the status quo, then change it. And not status quo the band, because I'm sure there are many people that still listen to status quo.
Yeah, possibly. Not me, but some people, I'm sure. Yeah.
What a likely.
Well, I think it's a great point. You know, we've talked quite a lot on the show about external feedback and, you know, external kind of networking and getting perspective, you know, externally, and just the importance with that. This is that on a whole other level, I suppose, but still aligns with kind of the same principles. And, you know, the one of the beauties of technology is, like, it's opened our eyes to what's outside of just the office space that we occupy on a daily basis, right? It's made us, like, consciously more aware of kind of our surroundings, and with that, you know, an opportunity to connect with more people. And typically what comes with that is a greater education, you know, now that kind of collaboration should hopefully yield more kind of steps towards positivity. And, you know, in the tech community, I think that there's clearly a need for that, especially with, you know, specifically talking about, you know, security at the moment. It's obviously kind of been ramped up by the press, and it's on a little bit more on the consciousness of people now, but there's still a tremendous amount of education that the average person needs to know about, you know, online security. So, you know, we need to be, you know, working collectively as a tech community to ensure that people are made aware of it who aren't in the tech community, and that message is being portrayed. So it's there is a sense of responsibility there for the people who understand it. And I think that when it comes to something as serious as security, you know, we should take it that way.
Yeah, but I don't think security is the term that we should be using. You know, when you use the word security, it's kind of seen as somewhat distant to everyday life, right? It's, I remember, you know, many people have said to me, oh, well, cybersecurity won't apply to me because, you know, I'm too small to be targeted, or I'm too small to be hit. And actually it's broader than that, because it to me, you know, if you've, like, I'll give you an example. So if you're a parent, then security may be the furthest thing from your mind, but actually you've got children that are going online. You've got children that are communicating with random strangers. You've got children who are potentially having malicious messages sent to them, and they may not tell you about it. And so it's about safety in many cases for parents. And, you know, equally it's about things like privacy and trust in the digital age, I think, is more than just, well, did I install antivirus? And I think that's one of the challenges that we've had, which is, you know, getting people to understand that what we talk about, what we do, what we protect against, it's not about viruses or ransomware or anything else like that. It has a real impact. And, you know, a great example was, you know, you remember the WannaCry, I use air quotes, right, ransomware attack. But, you know, WannaCry was a disruptive campaign which had huge ramifications all across the world. There are commercial companies that had a financial impact on them. You know, their quarterly revenue earnings for a major company were impacted. Now, what that means is that these companies aren't going to make as much money, which means that their reinvestment is going to be impacted, which means maybe the amount of jobs that they have are going to be impacted. Maybe the dividends to shareholders would be impacted. Or in healthcare, 8,000 operations were cancelled. And I saw this firsthand. I have we have a family member currently in a hospital. And on the Saturday, just like, you know, straight after WannaCry, you know, my phone was going off the hook. And I remember this particular individual saying to me, oh, yeah, they've taken off the internet. They've switched it off because, of course, they want to try to reduce the potential impact. And by Wednesday, I went to go and see this individual, and, you know, the internet was their only outlet. It was what they used to stay connected to the real world. And I actually saw the impact that it had, which was, you know, their mood, the outlook that they had, the positivity that they had, was actually impacted. And, you know, yes, okay, we talk about 8,000 operations, but actually, what about the thousands and thousands of people that weren't getting online? And I know it's a small thing, but that's really the key point that I'm trying to emphasize here, which is the work that we do has a material impact on the economy, on jobs, on our ability to be able to get medical care, you know, our ability to get about, our ability to communicate, and all of these things you kind of put up in this little bucket, which is security. And people go, oh, that's antivirus. Well, no, it's not. Actually, the work that we do has a significant material impact on the way that we live our lives.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think, you know, the kind of almost point I was referring to as well is that it's the education now, I feel, as much as anything, that is massively lacking. You know, and however we need to articulate these messages is also lacking. I've spoken to cyber people in the past, and, you know, I'm always conscious because, as you say, I'm not in cyber. I don't understand it to the fullest. I don't understand, you know, technically, or, you know, almost, I don't really understand fully practically how to, you know, best protect myself.
So let me challenge that point. You said I'm not in cyber. Well, first of all, right, I hate the term cyber anyway, but let's just go with those, you know, with that terminology. You are in cyber. Everybody's in cybersecurity. Data is being stored and protected by somebody, right? If you have a social media account, whether you have, even if you don't even have a computer, there is somebody somewhere that has a record of your demographics and your PII. And that data, it has to be protected. So every single person is in cybersecurity. Whether they work in that industry or whether they're getting money for it is irrelevant, but every single one of us have our data out there that we either A, personally need to protect, or that we entrust other people to protect on our behalf. You know, when you walk into, you know, when you sign up for, you know, when you go to the cinema, for example, and you sign up for one of their loyalty programs, you give them your personal data. You expect them to protect it for you. If you sign up for the internet, then, you know, you expect that company to look after and protect that data about you. If you have a bank account, you expect that bank to look after that data. So every single one of us are in cyber. Just some of us are actually getting, you know, working in the industry to protect the systems that hold data about us.
Yeah, I think that's kind of, I suppose, the point is that it's an education. I suppose this was the point I was trying to get to, is that it's the education that we're lacking, and I think that's where as you've just said, that's not quite as obvious to that won't be obvious to everyone, that they wouldn't realize that they are engaged in this, and everything that you're doing, you are involved in cyber and to some extent. This education and understanding how to best protect yourself, I think, is what we need to try and do, maybe as an industry or whoever is leading the push towards allowing the everyday person to better understand how to protect themselves. I feel that it's the education side of it, it is where we're massively lagging.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of content out there trying to educate. But actually, I think it's perhaps slightly deeper than that. And, I want to give you an example. So a long time ago when I was at university, I remember my girlfriend, who is now my wife, we went out one evening, and she was actually going through her finals, right, for the degree. And she had all of her notes in the car. And I remember, we parked up, and it was like a really dodgy area, right? Because this is where all the best restaurants are, right? Where all of the bad areas. So we parked up in a pretty bad neighborhood, and I locked the car, and we walked out, and I said, "God, blimey, I hope the car's still here when we get back." And she says, "Yeah, God, could you imagine if the car went?" She goes, "All of my data will be gone." And I said to her, I remember the conversation, I said, "Well, your data's not the valuable thing." I said, "It's the car." And she says, "No." And we didn't have an argument, but we had a disagreement there, straight there, which was, she was claiming that the data in the car was the asset, or was the most valuable asset, and I was claiming that the car itself was the most valuable asset. And by the way, don't tell her this, right? But she was right, which was the data was what was valuable. I could get insurance and I could get a new car, and it's pretty much a commodity, whereas the data is what's valuable. And I think that really kind of tells its own story, which is the perceived value of personal data, in other words, how we value the digital data about us, is probably the lowest it's ever been. I mean, I've seen people give data away for chocolate. I've seen people actually sign up to loyalty programs and actually pay money for the privilege. And I've always said, why would you pay twice? And they're like, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you're giving them your personal data and you're paying them, so that you're paying them twice. And so we're living in a world in which the perceived value of personal data is probably the lowest it's ever been, whereas the actual value of data, in other words, how companies value personal data, is probably the highest it's ever been. You look at the acquisition of WhatsApp, for example, is a great example whereby, here's a company that doesn't really generate a profit and yet sells for $18 billion. So it's more about changing this mindset, which is, what the data about me has monetary value. I look after my data. I'm going to protect that data. I'm going to make sure that, the company that I entrust with that data has the appropriate controls. And so it's about trying to change the perceived value of personal data. And I think, the only way we're going to do that is not kind of barking at people or putting more tweets out and so forth. But, when we start to see monetary models rewarding people for their personal data, then all of a sudden, I suspect people will begin to value their information and value their data more. Then once you can value that data, then you'll put the appropriate controls in place. So, why do I have an alarm on the car? Because it has monetary value. Why don't I install firewalls and antivirus on my systems? Because who cares, right? No one's going to attack me. And, even if they did, right, what's the worst that can happen? And so it's about trying to generate those business models for personal data that I think people would then be able to value the information about them more.
Yeah, I think so. It's sorry, I think went off for a sec there. It's interesting. It's very interesting, and I've heard kind of a couple of different takes on that. I think that people and companies are putting a high price on data and and what the use of it. But there's also, I've also heard, and just to throw the, you know, play devil's advocate as well, that the data is kind of a bubble, and is it really as valuable as we're kind of perceiving it? You know, valuations of WhatsApp, that's just a number, that's just a valuation. You know, tech valuations tend to be quite bloated. So is there, are we kind of over valuing data?
I don't think we value it enough. I mean, you know, every industry has changed, and every industry will continue to change. You know, according to the Boston Consulting Group, the personal data economy is going to be worth €1 trillion by 2020. And you know, you look at things like insurance, for example. You know, the fact is that they're using personal data to be able to provide, you know, to be able to track, you know, individuals' driving habits. And if you remember, the way we used to buy insurance even 10 years ago used to get a Yellow Pages and you used to sit down and go through it. Now, all of a sudden, you've got organizations tracking your every movement. You know, the My Data initiative by the UK government, for example, was another case in point whereby transactional data can be used to be able to provide and develop new services. And, you know, you look at loyalty programs within supermarkets, you look at loyalty programs within airlines. Heck, you'd even look at the recommendations features within and the personalized features within Amazon, for example. You know, all of these systems and all of these services are being delivered through data. So in my mind, you know, I think, you know, you can say tech valuations are bloated, but aren't tech valuations an indication of the way that society is moving towards if we're becoming a fully tech environment? And so in my eyes, I see, like, I have this discussion with my kids, and we're like, well, you know, I say to them, in 10 years' time, you're not going to be using pounds to pay for stuff. You're going to be using something else. You're going to be using either cryptocurrency, or you're going to be using personal data, or something else. And so it's an exciting time to be involved in this industry, because we literally are shaping the future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's never been more exciting to be involved in data, but you know, there's certainly flaws there, and there's a lot of skepticism as much as there is enthusiasm, and I think that somewhere kind of in the middle will be typically the outcome, maybe a 2.0 version of you know, like you say, it's exciting, and I hate to have to actually play devil's advocate, because normally it's actually the opposite, to be honest, when I talk with people about it. But you know, people are under this notion that it's, you know, Bitcoin and blockchain and all this kind of technology is kind of in a bit of a bubble, and it's flawed in many ways. I'll have to actually send you a podcast I recently did with someone who will be able to articulate their feelings towards it much better than I can. But, you know, and with regards to, without going down that rabbit hole, with regards to security, bubble or not, the industry is getting bigger, personal data is getting bigger, and, you know, we have to protect ourselves, right?
I think anybody that believes that technology is not going to be the foundation of every part of our lives, I think they're kidding themselves. You know, the way that we communicate, for example, is dictated through technology. I mean, you know, in the 1950s, J.A. Barnes, an anthropologist, goes to Norway, goes to a small fishing village, and, you know, comes up with this term called the social network. And that social network in the old days used to be based on physical proximity. In other words, I knew the baker, I knew the butcher, right? And you think about it today. You may know your next door neighbor, but you don't know the neighbor's neighbor. And when we were growing up, we knew everybody on the street. And in other words, our networks were derived of physical proximity. In other words, the people around us. Well, now in 2017, your social network is not based on physical proximity. It's based upon people with which you share common interests. You know, I'm sure you've got friends that you've never met. You've got friends that are thousands of miles from you, and you communicate either through Facebook or Twitter or WhatsApp, or, you know, other communication methods. And the reason that you built up this social network is because, you know, you share a common interest. Well, technology has changed the way that you have friends. I mean, that's the impact that technology had. It's so fundamental. And so if we think that we're going to be able to do that, you know, if we think we're going to be able to go back to what it was 50 to 60 years ago, I mean, I don't see how that's going to happen. Unless, you know, unless this peak oil crisis actually comes to fruition. But I don't see how that's going to happen. So that's the impact that it's had. It's so fundamental. It's to the very fabric of even how we make friends.
Yeah, I do agree. I think that there's technology is fundamentally, or I think it's already fundamentally a part of everyone's life, right? I don't think there's much denying that, and it's just going to be increasingly so, and it's going to be to the point where it changes, how people are, the jobs that we occupy. There's going to be a lot of jobs that are going to become eliminated because of kind of automation and such, where a lot of these jobs that we consider low-level jobs that can be automated will be automated. And so it will continuously impact the way that we fundamentally work as people. I think that as far as, technology and getting to know people, I think as humans, there's still a difference between that person-to-person interaction, and that will always be there, and there will always be, variables that I think computers might not be able to consider because we're irrational humans. But I think that it will impact us to a certain extent, to far beyond what I'm sure we can comprehend now even.
Oh, either way, it's going to be fun, right? Either way, it's going to be exciting. And either way, you know, there's opportunities, right? Yes, there are risks. And, you know, yes, there are jobs that will be automated. But equally, there's going to be new jobs. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't know the term CTO ever existed. You know, when we were going through university, social media manager, and I say the word we, right, because I guess I'm older than you, but, you know, by the time, you know, when I was going through university, social media managers meant nothing. CIO wasn't even a term. And so that's the beauty of the world around us is that, you know, today, and actually when I go to speak at schools, I talk to kids and I'll be like, well, you all have Twitter accounts. Yeah, you do. And they say, well, you know, you have the opportunity to interact with people with whose jobs and careers you want to emulate. You know, you can follow their, and I remember this one kid puts his hand up and he says, yeah, I want to be a physio. And I was like, well, the England rugby physio, I said, I'm sure he's on Twitter. I'm sure he's on LinkedIn. You can connect with them. You can talk to them. And that never happened back in, you know, when I was going through university. When, you know, I used to have to send them a letter and hope that they'd send a letter back. So these are the opportunities that we have before us. And yeah, you know, the work that I work in and many of the cybersecurity industry is, you know, we recognize that there are risks, but that's what we do. We identify those risks and we manage those risks to a level that are acceptable. But, you know, fundamentally, these are the opportunities not only for business, but also for kids coming through it and even the likes of you and I.
I agree. I as you say, it's exciting, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. It's exciting, and as long as you know, we protect ourselves, it might be. You know, what were the remember the crossing the road things in school that they used to have, the safety bear and all that kind of stuff? I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, the green cross code.
Yeah, the green cross code and all that kind of stuff. But I think that, you know, as long as we have whatever that equivalent would be, maybe we can call it a different kind of bear or animal or something. But for, you know, cybersecurity, maybe that's how common it's going to be. And that's how we'll get the information across to people at such a young age. I think that's... a green cross code for cyber. What about that?
Well, you know, we've recently done some work at Bletchley Park, which is obviously the birthplace of our industry. And what I would encourage everybody listening to this is, you know, if you have kids, take them to Bletchley Park. You know, we've got an exhibition about cybersecurity. You can walk the halls that Alan Turing did. But I think not only are we teaching them around online safety, because we've actually got a We've actually sponsored a teacher to be on site. But actually, you can inspire kids about, you know, working in this industry, because it's exciting. It's a really exciting industry to be in. And so there are opportunities and there are places that you can go. And, you know, if you're in the UK and you haven't been to Bletchley Park at least 5 to 10 times, then, you know, get yourself down there and take your kids and take your family and take your friends as well.
I like that. And it's probably a good point to finish on. It's been a pleasure, Raj. I wish we could talk for a little bit longer, but I know, you know, you're very busy. So I'll let us get off and hopefully we can do it again soon. But thank you so much for the talk. I really enjoyed what you had to say today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.